Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Mark Boyden. Mark Boyden is the director of the Streamscapes Project, which over the past 30 years has worked with communities across Ireland to celebrate salmon and the wider biodiversity that is all dependent upon high water quality, as well as raising awareness of the impacts that we have on water, species, and habitats through our pursuit of livelihood, recreation, and domestic management. So before we start, it is streamscapes.ie, S-T-R-E-A-M-S-C-A-P-E-S, streamscapes.ie. So first, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thanks to you, Derek, for inviting me on. It looks really interesting.
So I have written extensively and interviewed extensively and thought extensively and cried extensively about salmon in the Pacific Northwest. And I know almost nothing about their relatives in Ireland. So can you give us an introduction to salmon in Ireland?
Yes, of course. I'll try. The wild salmon of Ireland is the Atlantic salmon, and it's genetically and completely distinct from any of your Pacific salmon. We just have one salmon per se in the Atlantic, Salmo salar, and it's an incredible thing. It would be more related to the steelhead of the Pacific Northwest. In so much as it doesn't necessarily, die after spawning. If it is able to make it back to the sea into the Atlantic and feed up again, it can potentially spawn a second and even up to a third or fourth time. But it's a wonderful fish. Really the history in Ireland, goes back what's reckoned to be the earliest, human settlement in Ireland was in County Derry, Mount Sandal, and excavations there revealed that salmon were surplus salmon catch was being smoked there over 7,000 years ago, and it's been central to in Ireland in terms of nutrition and culture and commerce. Ever since, you know, it's just, you know, but also the mythology, the stories, the Loric tradition, it's quite deep, and it's in the soul of every Irish person as well. It's kind of fallen on hard times though, over the last, particularly in the last century. Ireland missed most of the Industrial Revolution. And so, whereas the Atlantic salmon has suffered, say, in the Rhine and in continental Europe for 250 to 300 years, in Ireland, really the decrease in numbers and health of stocks has happened chiefly in the last century and increasingly so in the last 40 or 50 years. And I suppose that the issues would be similar to the Pacific salmon in your territory as well. In terms of, obstructions of river channels by weirs or dams or things like that. But also, you know, heavy earthworks, road building, afforestation, clear fell, heavy farming, urban runoff. I'd say it's very similar issues. Salmon for me, in reaching for another language, you know, I like the feng shui approach, which looks at qi and sha, and literally that ideogram for qi in the Chinese, is running water, and sha, which is the opposite, is stagnant water. And salmon very much are diviners of qi. And if you provide that in your landscape, in your waterscapes, then you will have salmon in abundance. And if you remove that, or if it gets lost, then the salmon are going to go away, and they're going to go somewhere else where they'll find that chi, you know. And so that's wonderful about salmon. We can learn from salmon, and we can learn about what really our valleys, our landscapes, our catchments, our watersheds should look like. Because we want, if we're sane at all, we want salmon's presence. Then once we're faced with these issues, I suppose, you know, we're concerned with interventions to welcome salmon back where they haven't, where they've gone down in numbers or suffered. And obviously there's interventions at many levels happening, at kind of local level in terms of town councils and county councils in Ireland, then also at regional level, from state authorities and one thing another, and national. I'm full of praise for the people involved, both in the civil service and as well from the private sector. There's some really, there's people with big hearts and incredible intellects and incredible feel for landscape issues. And they're going about it, in a good way. There's hopes in a lot of watersheds or catchments, as we call them, that we've turned the corner, that we hopefully have bottomed out in terms of salmon disappearing. Our current project within Streamscapes is called Salmon Sanctuaries. And I think I provided you with the PDF of that. It can also be found on our website. It's free to download. And sanctuaries in the sense that refuges for endangered or threatened beings, whether, you know, I mean, sanctuaries are for people, but they can be for wildlife as well. And in the case of salmon, we just felt that we had to bring home the message to people that if they still had an extant native wild salmon population in their midst, then it was so vital to hold on to it and to learn, number one, the wonders, and then number two, the best practices which would vouchsafe its survival. But sanctuaries has this second meaning too, and that is of a sacred place. And it's to remind our own Streamscapes participants about, you know, how we can create this sacred space within our landscape and how we can make sure that we realize that we are sharing our homes with salmon. You know, we try to bring in creative approaches, to schools and to community groups and to sectoral interests, whether we're working with farmers or foresters or whoever, things like viewing our taps and faucets and toilets as tributaries to the river, and then bringing home the message that we're not apart from our rivers and we're not apart from all of the habitats and species. We're just another kind of cousin who dwells with all of these. And, and I suppose echoing the Gaia theme, you know, that we're all absolutely dependent upon each other and that we need each other. But we put a lot of thought, I suppose, into, Streamscapes development. We're at it for over 30 years now, since the late 1980s. And because I had been involved in environmentalism, before that, I had the benefit of seeing a lot of the kind of plus sides and negative sides of environmental activism. And I just thought that if we were going into education, we had to be very careful about the the psychology of engagement. You speak very movingly about the psychology involved, people with other people, people with the earth, people with environment. And that would really resonate with a lot of what we've tried to do here in Ireland. We come from a place of respect. Generally, there's three main pillars addressing the environment in the last 50, 60 years. And it's policy, it's legislation, and it's enforcement. Now, there's many ways to, apart from those three pillars, to engage with environment or environmental activism. But we plucked for this kind of what we call the fourth estate, which is kind of the role of an honest broker who develops pathways to environmental education. And that's really what spawned Streamscapes. And the psychology that influenced that was very much, as I say, respect, and respect for all, catchment watershed citizens, where they're coming from and where we're trying to go, and listening, very much listening and respecting the need to create. I mean, in our case, we're more working with rural communities than urban communities, but we're also very concerned with the sustainability of rural communities, and they depend on livelihoods that depend upon the landscape. So, it's all kind of bound up with working with ultimately stewards of the land, stewards, whether they're farmers or whatever, and appealing to their intelligence to come up with solutions to some of the impacts that we're generating as Anthropocenes on salmon, on freshwater resources, and ultimately on the seas as well. So very much we were concerned with developing a clear ethos and methodology. And we're concerned with wonder, as I say, revealing wonder, and trusting that will move people to become conscious and voluntary stewards of these wonderful landscapes that we find ourselves living in.
Well, thank you for all that. I love what you said, and I'm going to do sort of a question dump here. I'm just going to dump like a half dozen questions on you, and you can take any of them you want. Some of them have to do with specifically Atlantic salmon. I still don't know a lot about them, and so some questions might be, I've read accounts like of the Klamath River about 20 miles south of where I live, that it was as late as the 1930s, black and roiling with fish. And the Klamath's a pretty big river. So were there that many Atlantic salmon too, that the rivers would be? I've seen pictures in Alaska of a river, not a stream, where you can't even see the bottom of the river because there's so many fish. So did it used to be like that? Next question is, I know so little about Ireland. I'm sorry. Was a lot of it forested prior to the industrial age, and you talked about clear felling. Is that a problem too of stream temperature? Another question, and sorry for dumping all these. Who eats salmon? Like here, it's bears, eagles. So among non-humans, because we know humans eat them, and that's great. Among non-humans, who would eat salmon in Ireland? And then also, since they can go back to the ocean, are they like Pacific salmon that they return to their own stream like 90% or 95% of the time? Or would it be reasonable to have a whole bunch of salmon are in Ireland for one time and then they decide to go to Germany? Or does that not happen? And then last, for now, You talked about these solutions and working with landowners. Can you give an example, any example, of working with a specific landowner to solve a problem that was on that person's land that then they and the salmon were both happy?
Yeah. Okay. Great. The first question with regards, you know, abundance of stocks. Yes, it would have been the same here. There was, you know, the anecdotal stories, from times past were that, you know, looking at a river, you'd see more salmon than water on the surface during a seasonal run. So yes, that was true here. That day is long gone. We hope to see it again. And I should say that we had last year was the best year in probably over 30 years, but we're aware of false baseline syndrome too. So we're not completely dancing, because what we've achieved is, you know, just a possibly, catching up with where we were 30 years ago instead of 100 years ago, which has to be considered the true baseline. With regards, afforestation, Ireland was thickly forested following the Ice Age. Plants and trees, recolonized, mainly moving in over, land bridges, which, disappeared with, recession of the ice and the melting of the ice and the raising of the sea levels. But there was an entire cycle of trees which then populated the Irish landscape, you know, starting with the birches and things like that and going through to some conifers, native conifers and one thing or another. They were all cleared. They were literally not, I'm not joking. They were 98% cleared, over about 500 years from 1500 to 2000, even before. And they were felled for industrial purposes. It's a common thing that said that the oaks of Ireland built the British Navy. And things like that. But there was also a lot of other industrial uses. And the chief one probably, which was making charcoal to be taken to temperature to smelt ores as well. There was a lot of industrial iron ore smelters and one thing or another. And what's happened since, you know, in the 100 years since independence, was that the state decided to reafforest Ireland. But there's a lot of shortcomings in the way that policy has been enacted. There's been a lot of inappropriate plantings and inappropriate land disturbance, which has required deep drainage and one thing or another, and of course impacted in terms of releasing silts in the form of clays and topsoil and nutrients and one thing or another into the rivers, which has contributed in a major way to their despoiling. Who eats salmon? You were mentioning bears in your country. In Ireland, only seals and otters and certain other predatory marine fish would eat mature salmon. But the younger stages, the juvenile stages, of salmon from ova on, from eggs on through, right through fry and par and smolts and all the juvenile stages, really feed the whole food web of heron and kingfisher and dipper and also young Otter as well. But but people don't really eat wild salmon in Ireland anymore. Now it would be a story in itself, so I'm not going to go there. Only that that there was sea harvest of salmon up until about 12 years ago, and that was stopped because it was identified as one of the reasons why salmon numbers were suffering. Now, of course, it was only one of 100 cuts, or maybe 1,000 cuts, but it's very difficult to actually procure and eat a wild salmon in Ireland now. It's more or less forbidden unless it's caught in a draft net. What was banned was multi-stock interceptory fishes, anything that was out to 6 miles at sea. And what remains is a few river-specific, what are called draft nets, which are restricted to the estuary of a single river. And it was adopted as kind of a management tool, because if you had a river kind of adjacent to a river, if you had one river that wasn't doing well adjacent to a river that was doing all right, you wouldn't be able to distinguish between what you were catching. Do they return to their own stream? Well, I suppose that's the rule of thumb that applies. Is that a salmon returns not only to its own river and its own stream, but even, quite often, even the bed of gravel, the red, as the nest is called, that, you know, where it itself hatched. But, you know, kind of an interesting aspect of salmon and salmon biology, and you can relate it back to, you know, all kinds of animal behavior, including human behavior, is that what interests me is the one who wanders as well, because some salmon do go under trigger to go somewhere else. And this is what ensures that salmon remain really adaptable, because landscapes change. You might have a waterfall that literally might collapse a bit or would change in such a way that where migration was impossible before, the possibility opens up. And so salmon, by pushing out that envelope, they go, I wonder if I can go up this tributary. And they try and they try and they might die, but they keep trying. And eventually maybe a few salmon make it up there and it becomes new habitat. So it's quite informative for all of us that even in our society, we need people who return to the same bed to spawn. But we also need people who innovate and find new paths as well. So I think there's a lesson in there. And then your last query, I think, was examples of landowners. Yeah, I mean, it's as simple a matter, and I'm sure this is repeated across many countries, where, you know, cattle, say, coming too close to a river bank might collapse it. And so not only does the farmer lose land, but also the resultant, siltation in the river limits life in amongst the gravel and the nutrients drive up potential pollution in one thing or another. So yeah, I mean, time and again, we've seen people, adopt, just the simple practice of fencing their stock back from the river, you know, respecting a riparian zone and allowing appropriate trees to grow and keeping banks from collapsing into rivers.
Thank you for that. You mentioned earlier the importance of salmon culturally, and I don't know if you used the word spiritually, but it seemed to be implied. Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if this is the appropriate word, salmon lore or salmon culturally for the Irish?
Yeah, the I suppose the archetypal story is the story of the salmon of knowledge. And it involves Finnegas, the druid, and he lived on the banks of the River Boyne, which is kind of up north of Dublin, if you know any Irish geography, and it flows into the Irish Sea. But at one time it was a very good salmon river. And so back, you know, in time immemorial, it was, Finnegas, you know, he was trying to catch the salmon who would give him all of the wisdom of the world. And finally, after years of trying, he caught it. And he gave it to his servant, who was called Demna, to roast it on a spit above a fire. And he warned Demna not to eat the smallest bit of the fish, of the salmon of knowledge. But Demna was minding the fish, and as it cooked, he just wanted to check to see how well cooked it was. So he poked it with his thumb, and it burnt his thumb. So he thrust his thumb into his mouth, and didn't think much more about it, although a strange feeling came over him. But so when Finnegas came back to check on him and the salmon, he noticed the light and fire of wisdom in Demna's eyes and said, "Have you eaten of the salmon?" "No," Demna replied, "but when I was turning it on the spit, it burned my thumb and I put it into my mouth." And, you know, Finnegas threw up his hands and said, "That is enough. You have eaten of the salmon of knowledge, and in you, the prophecy is fulfilled. Your name is Finn McCool." So it's, everyone going to school in Ireland learns that story. And it has to do with the preservation and rediscovery of ancient wisdom and ancient knowledge.
And it seems that one of the key factors in that is that the wisdom comes from the natural world. The wisdom comes from the salmon, and that would seem to me to be in sort of contradistinction to a sort of human supremacist notion that humans are the only source of knowledge or wisdom on the planet.
Yeah, no, this would be a much more, to coin a term, egalitarian world. You know, it would be that there are, you know, wisdom is in the landscape, wisdom is in, you know, gnarled old trees, and, you know, even stones have names. And so it would be other than that. It wouldn't be so, human centric, you know. It would take in more other wisdom. I might have cut across you there.
No. I was just going to say, if you want, that seems to be a nice segue to you talking a bit about the education efforts. And so I'm going to tell a little story, and then this may be completely irrelevant to you. We'll see. That I interviewed someone about king cobra bites in India. And I don't remember the number, but king cobra bites kill like 50,000 people per year, some huge number of Indians every year. And as I was interviewing him, his main job is education. I said, because of that, is there a great hatred of the king cobras? And he said, no, not at all. People love them. So actually my education is simply to get people to wear rubber boots when they go outside. And it's very technical. And then I contrast that with, I grew up in the Western United States, and in the Western United States, there is tremendous general hatred of wolves and coyotes and other predators. And so environmental education in the Western United States having to do with coyotes and wolves and other predators is not simply technical, like what you were saying about putting in a fence on a stream, but instead it's a lot of overcoming general cultural dislike. And so a couple questions about salmon education. One is just generally, what do you do and how is it received? And second, do many of the people with whom you communicate, do they love salmon, but they just don't know about it much? Or do they not think about salmon at all? When you often go to see someone, do you find resistance? I'm talking both about schools and landowners. Do you find resistance to protecting salmon? Do you find, oh, I just didn't know this, that's a great idea? Or do you find a latent love that just needs to be sort of, to switch metaphors, you know, put the flame to it?
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. Although there is a distinction in our community engagements, you know, younger people, and I'm saying, you know, 20 to 40, won't be as au fait with the environment and with you know, subjects on nature and wildlife as those from 60 to 80. People of 60 to 80 have far, far the greater store of stories to relate about wildlife that they saw in their youth or interacted with or, you know, had something to do with. And then, so, you know, it's almost like these subjects were part and parcel of, say, a coming of age or whatever, 80 years ago, 100 years ago. And then there's kind of a lull. It's almost like we get distracted for a generation or two or maybe three from these subjects. But then, because of the growth in environmental education and outdoor education, I think things are turning around again. I mean, certainly we always think that, you know, one of the chief vectors to communicate with a community is through, you know, primary school students, because they have such a natural love of all these creatures, all this wildlife and everything. I mean, a central part of all engagements that we do with all ages is to get them into the river and, you know, and look at aquatic insects. And so for one reason, because you can be taught fairly simply how to gauge the water quality of your own local river through kind of a cursory census of what you find. If you find, you know, stoneflies and mayflies and caddis, you know, it's a great sign. If you just find worms and snails and things, then, you know, it's pretty polluted because only they can tolerate higher levels of pollution. But we're trying to add to that. We're trying to add to that general kind of baseline awareness of these issues. And as I said earlier, you know, how we impact on that, how our own pursuit of livelihood, recreation, domestic management, you know, impacts on the wildlife around us. I think that's crucial, you know, but also, you know, it's funny when you mention, you know, wolves and bears and coyotes and things, you know, we've lost all of our, large mammals here, thousands of years ago. I mean, there were bears here. There were wolves. The last wolf was shot on Mount Leinster in, about 1750. There were elk, massive elk, and they're all long, long gone. And so when we speak of these, you know, kind of larger mammals and we're talking about rewilding, and looking for the means to reestablish habitats where they might thrive. Now that's a delicate subject. In the racial memory, you know, there were threats posed by a lot of these species and one thing or another. So we have to address that as well. But it's important to rebuild, that whole population of all the animals that are natural to a landscape. And I think, you know, we have to go on trying to find a way to do it. But in the meantime, you know, when people ask me about rewilding, my take is, start with yourself, rewild yourself and find that wildness, that we otherwise, necessarily have to compromise. I think it's important, to establish a relationship with, the natural world. You have to remember the wild levels of your own psyche as well. I think that's important just for every person's journey as well, you know.
So I love that. And I have a question about that in a moment, but there's another, I'm going to go back to a physical thing about salmon that I forgot to ask earlier. You said something about seasonal runs, and I know in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of times there would be a fall run Chinook, a spring run Chinook. There might be multiple runs through a year. And if we look back traditionally or historically in Ireland or prehistorically, would there have been, how many runs of salmon would there have been a year? Is there just a spring run, or is there a run every season, or what's the deal?
Depends on the river. Bigger rivers have a greater variety of runs. You could get the first salmon appearing in January, even on the 1st of January of a given year. In smaller rivers, smaller spate rivers, as we call them, because they rise and fall literally with every passing rain event. You might only have a summer run and a bit of an autumn run. But it's, you know, again, this is nature's way of ensuring that there's this huge variability, so that any given species can be resilient in the face of anything in terms of climate or whatever might arise. And we've even seen where, a lot of spring fish might have been, fished out of a given river, you know, fish that would have come in, say, in April or May. And if they had been fished out, or if they had been eliminated by some other cause, then you develop a population which will come later in the year. And the reason for that is that the offspring of the other fish, which have a tendency to replicate their parents' lifestyle, suddenly have a much greater amount of juvenile habitat to utilize. And so they start to thrive. And gradually, you know, and this goes back to the variability in the salmon. Eventually that population, you know, strays from that population will repopulate, the spring, you know, kind of the temporal, seasons as well as the spatial river. So, you know, it's dynamic. you might have to wait 20, 30 years to see these things happen, but they do happen.
So two stories from me. One is when I was, I still remember when I was in third grade, which would be 8 years old, somewhere in there. My school took all of us on a field trip to a farm right next door. And I still remember seeing the owls in the farmer's barn and seeing the mouse, the owl pellets, you know, when they regurgitate the mouse skin or the mouse fur and everything. I still remember seeing those when I was in third grade and just the feeling, you know, I don't remember anything else about that entire school year, but I remember that. Okay. Now we fast forward to, I grew up in the continental West, not in salmon territory, and then moved to salmon territory as an adult. And whenever I go to a salmon, to see salmon spawn, I can't stop crying because I'm so moved. And so can you give me, or give listeners, a couple of stories, well, as many stories as you want, about a nice story about kids going to salmon habitat. And you already talked about the insects. Can you talk a little bit about them seeing salmon? And then can you have a nice story about some adult, like a landowner or somebody else, somebody from the city, it doesn't matter, seeing salmon? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah. Yeah. We wouldn't always see salmon on these field trips, but we might discover sometimes a salmon would leap, you know, in a good river in season. And then the other thing is that we might, in the course of, you know, either school kids netting or even, you know, adult community members, getting in the river, you know, we might catch juvenile ones and one thing or another. So yeah, that's always a high point, even just to catch a juvenile and look at it and explain about the, how the scales tell a story and one thing or another. And just them hearing about the life cycle. And then also there's a very interesting, symbiosis that happens. There's a relationship between juvenile salmon and our brown trout for that matter and our freshwater pearl mussel and, the pearl mussel. And this always fascinates, you know, all the younger students and the older people as well. But the fact that when our mussel, Margaritifera margaritifera spawns, the spawn goes off from the female and, you know, hundreds and thousands of them. And they're only viable if they're in effect breathed in and latch on to the gill of the juvenile salmon or the juvenile trout. And without harming the fish, because they just hold on with just a little hook. And so it's not a parasitical thing. But they hitch a ride on salmon, and this is how our mussels disperse through river systems. In turn, the mussels, being bivalves, they filter the water and they remove, kind of nutrients from the river, and they use it to build their own shells and to grow their own flesh. And so it's this wonderful thing. There was research done on a river in Russia, and it was estimated that 94% of the water in the river had passed through a mussel from source to sea. And you know, this is another one of those stories of wonder that just excite people, and you know, and kind of, you know, as you say, you know, they stay with you, you know, these stories and these images. The other thing I suppose is that I can remember being on a river in County Fermanagh in Northern Ireland, and four generations of a family came along, and literally, you know, they had a farm beside the river. And even though the grandfather, I should say the great grandfather present, you know, had a great knowledge of of the fish and the birds of the area and one thing another. He didn't know about the insects, the aquatic insects. And so this absolutely blew his mind. You know, he was, you know, when we laid them out in a tray and we were talking about their life cycles, you know, I mean, a lot of people would know about the mayfly that, you know, that spends 3 years underwater and goes through a few moultings, then finally, you know, flies for one day and mates on the wing and then dies. You know, and he was just ecstatic at learning about this. And he, and, you know, you cite your own tears. He was in tears. He was saying, I've lived there above there for, you know, all my life. And I never realized that all these bugs were having this life down here below me, you know? And then of course the message that, you know, that, that we could help the bugs and the bugs would help the fish. And the fish would help everything. So it all ties together, you know, it's, yeah, but I'd love your owl story too. Yeah, because it also reminds me that, you know, I'm doing this long enough now that I have people in their 40s come up to me and say, oh, Mr. Boyden, I remember when you guys came to our school. And then they'll kind of gaze off for a moment and they'll say, that was the best day of school ever. But it was just because they were outside and it was real and it wasn't an abstract lesson from a book. It was their river. It was, you know, they themselves in their river and learning about the whole relationship between them and their river and their valley.
So we just have a couple minutes left. Thank you for that. We just have a couple minutes left. And could you talk just a little bit about your organization? And then after that, can you, one of the things I really want to do with all of these radio programs is to help activate people, to get them from feeling, gosh, I should do something to doing something. So, first, can you talk just a little bit about your organization? And second, can you talk a little bit about if someone is moved by what you've said, and I don't know how they wouldn't be, if someone is moved by what you've said, how they can start to replicate some of these impulses wherever they live about whatever beings they feel most impassioned about?
Yeah. Streamscapes, it's kind of, you know, we're kind of a loose collective. You know, we started off really as a think tank because environmental education wasn't really on the radar in Ireland back in the mid-1980s. And so we moved to fill that gap. And we started off at a very local level. We've always been small. We only do a handful of projects every year, but we're invited in by, say, you know, a local government or a regional government, who see a problem with water quality, species or habitats, and they believe or subscribe to the notion that if people can be gotten up to speed, you know, as I say, it's this two-part thing where first reveal the wonder and then learn the best practice. And so, you know, if you're switched on to the wonder, you know, then you're pretty motivated to carry on and find out what you can do and what role you can play. And really to answer the second part of your question, I suppose, that's it. You have to look into best practice. It doesn't matter what you do. There's a way to do it, and it doesn't happen. It doesn't have to cost a lot of money or investment to just do it better. If you're cleaning your toilet with ammonia-based bleaches and things, try lemon juice. You know, it's as simple as that. Because all these heavy cleaning agencies remove the kind of efficacy of sewage treatment, and And that, you know, that costs you more taxes, and that costs you in terms of your wildlife cousins and your local water quality and the ability to go swimming and everything. It's wonders and it's best practice. And that's what Streamscapes has been about. As I say, you know, that respect is so important. We don't point the finger. We felt there was enough people pointing fingers, and I acknowledge that there's many ways to respond to, to environmental activism. We chose, education and respect. You know, we work with people on their own terms, and we like to believe that if they're made aware of these wonders, they will respond intelligently. And, you know, that's a thing we say from time to time. You know, we're surrounded by such intelligence in the countryside, such adaptability. And so maybe all we can do really is to try to be as intelligent as the world around us. But maybe, could I make a suggestion? Sure. I don't want to talk all that much about Streamscapes or anything. I mean, you know, hundreds of individuals and organizations are doing wonderful work all around the world. I'm aware of similar efforts on, you know, out in the Northwest Coast where you are. but maybe could I finish by just reading a little poem I've got?
Please, please.
Okay, I better take a sip of water. I'm getting a bit hoarse. Okay, it's called We Haven't a Clue.
And who's did you write it? Did somebody else write it?
I wrote this.
Okay, great.
And it's just I write odd poems. I'm not a poet. but once in a while I'm moved to put pen to paper. We haven't a clue about water, really. In some distant epoch to be, our illustrious descendants and their hard-won gadgetry will, with probes, play back every emotion that rivers ever suckled from time. It will be heard and listened to as music. Arias, fugues, rhythm and blues, and then we will know or surmise what we have always known. And there will come a knowing that we are water talking about water. Water singing from the altar, seeking that knowing, wanting to worship, to be a flow, a wave's crest, an icicle, melting. Tears in our eyes, and all of our tears will come together, become a waterfall which we sit beside as salmon ascend, and all of those long days of ringing shall beget joy.
I love that. And thank you so much for doing this interview, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Mark Boyden. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Writer Network.